Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel, and proud member of the Robots Radio Podcast Network. My name is Arimithius, and today we're carrying on our look at the Truth and Sequence, starting off with Volume 3 this time. But before we kick off, I wanted to say thank you and I'm sorry to one of my latest patrons, Kurt Zablu, who signed up around about 2 weeks ago, I think, but I managed to not do any sort of form of shout out. So thank you very much, Kurt Zablu, for signing up and becoming a patron, and I'm sorry I missed you out the first time round. And if you want to become a patron, dear listener, then you can go along to patreon.com/writteninuncertainty and get access to all of the notes that I make for all of the episodes I'm producing here, as well as getting access to all of my content early, which includes the podcasts and the YouTube videos, some of which I'm now starting to actually start uploading again. But anyways, we should probably get back to the Truth and Sequence and the sermons of Deldries Morvain. I think in the vein of carrying on musings from previous casts, I should probably point out that these are taken from sermons of Deldries Morvain, so we don't know whether or not they're the whole thing or whether they're just extracts from the sermons. So there's possibly something else to it. The way that these are structured makes me think they're quite self-contained, and they're definitely written to be that way out of universe. We don't get access to the whole of the sermons simply because it would take forever to write that much material, I think. But it would be interesting to know quite what else there was that has been missed out here, and speculate to what the whole extent of those sermons are. We're just seeing extracts at this point. But anyway, to Volume 3. By the word, I grind the gears. The third truth of the mainspring ever wound is the truth of the Daedra. And I just want to pause for a second there. The way that these sermons are structured makes, and the way that they all seem to kind of have themes, like Volume 2 talked about names and privation and the way that names work and how the absence of a name makes Sophocil better and whole and so on. So it's quite clear from the way that this is phrased, like the third truth, that we're dealing with sequential revelations of a truth, and that these are kind of core tenets of the Clockwork Apostles' faith. So what Deldries might be doing here is feeding off some form of other teaching that's been made, possibly by Sophocil, about the true nature of Nirn and everyone's place in the world, and kind of extrapolating from those. But this is all about the truth of the Daedra and how the Daedra and Oblivion relate to Mundus, and potentially how they don't as well, or how they shouldn't anyway. In the days before the first ignition, the Chimer people bent their knees to the false princes, the web spinner, the prince of plots, and the queen of dawn and dusk. I do not use their names, as name cleaves one from the other. Now, there's part of me that thinks that description does the same thing here. It doesn't really feel quite right that just to say that Boethia is something that defines a thing, but Prince of Plots and unlawful overthrow of authority and all the rest of their attributes doesn't in some way define the Prince of Plots and split her from the rest of creation. It just feels a little superficial to me, if I'm honest. And one that's possibly worth thinking about here, the days before the first ignition. This is talking about the Chimer as they were when they left Somerset and travelled to Vardenfell. So the first ignition, I'm not really sure, but I think that this is possibly looking at the first ignition as the ascension of the tribunal and Sotha Sil becoming a god. As these guys worship Sotha Sil, that makes sense to me, but we don't have any real indication of precisely what the first ignition is, but I think it's not an unreasonable assumption that it's the ascension of the tribunal. You know them well, Trial of the Tribunal, for every time you bear false witness or make foolish boasts, you do so in their name. Their words corrode and weaken the heart. Their threats loosen the fasteners and break the seals. They are the anti-gears that turn counter to the nameless will. Servants of the Padmaic untruth whose nature is void. Of the Daedra, only the Grey Prince of Order knew his nature, and he went mad in the knowing. This is interesting because we've got anti-gears, the Etada gears that have been talked about before, and they're imperfect and need to be improved on, whereas the Daedra are antithetical to creation. We've got a very Manichaean distinction between Daedra and Aedra in how the Clockwork Apostles are thinking about the Etada here. Although potentially, now I think about it, it's not the Aedra gears that are talked about, but the Etada gears. So we have gears and anti-gears, both being forms of gears, if you see what I mean, in the same way that matter and antimatter are technically forms of matter, if you like. They've just got the polarity of their electrons reversed, if I remember rightly. And in the same way here, the Daedra are very definitely creations. They are associated with void and lack and so on in this passage, but they are still very definitely things. They are not an absence of things in quite the same way. And there's also a normative component here that's being talked about. The every time you tell a lie or make foolish boasts or do something bad, in short, you are doing the will of the Daedra. It's, again, going back to that very Manichaean way of doing things. It's things are either good or bad, and there is no in-between. As much as Sotha Sil himself craves the maybe and the grey things, the worship of him doesn't permit that sort of division at all. And the Grey Prince of Order is an interesting one. The Grey Prince of Order is very definitely Jigalag. And he's associated with greyness here and the uncertainty and that brings the grey maybe, which is a little strange because Jigalag is all about determinism and knowing all that has been and all that will be and so on and so forth. But we also have an alternative origin for Shi'agorath here. The way that it gets explained in The Elder Scrolls IV is that the other Daedric princes didn't like Jigalag. They thought he was too powerful, and so they ganged up on him and turned him into Shi'agorath. Whereas here, we have Jigalag having some sort of revelation about the truth of reality, and that driving him mad, and that insight being the thing that turned him into Shi'agorath. There's part of me that thinks that because Shi'agorath and Jigalag are definitely distinct entities, and rather than just one person who's had a personality change, that the Clockwork Apostles are wrong in their assessment of Jigalag here. But it's an interesting idea nonetheless. I think that Jigalag was driven mad by this full deterministic universe and knowing his place in it, probably, that is what turned him into Shi'agorath. And there are also some interesting parallels between Jigalag and Sotha Sil. You have Sotha Sil also being very deterministic, also saying that causal events and causal chains mean that there is no real choice, that it's just someone's nature to do such and such a thing, which aligns him quite closely with Jigalag. But because that Jigalag is a Daedra, then Jigalag is default bad, probably. Although, again, going back to the painting of Jigalag as grey here, I'm not 100% sure of that, even as I say it, because if we're being black and white about things, that that the Aedra could be better and the Daedra are terrible and bad and wrong, then if Jigalag is grey, then is he redeemable? Is he different in some sense? The Daedra fear wisdom and order, you see, and thus they fear the Clockwork God above all others. And I find that interesting because it pitches Sothisil as kind of the arch enemy of the Daedra, even as Azura is claimed to be Sothisil's anticipation and therefore potentially worthwhile and good in some way. Although, as I've said before when going through these, this diverges quite significantly from mainstream tribunal faith, and that's possibly one of the ways that this is most obvious. And I also think that that fear, if that's the case, that's one of the possible reasons for the Cold Harbor Compact. We don't actually know why Sothisil was able to convince those various princes to stop their meddling on Nern, but they did, and quite what he could offer them is something that's puzzled scholars both in-universe and out. And so, but if the Daedra fear the Clockwork God in some way, if they fear what Sothisil can do and his provision of order as such, then he has a bargaining chip. He has some leverage to make them uncomfortable and therefore force them to do something. Again, quite what that is unclear, but it may just be enough that the Daedra believe it to be so. Where others see dark crowns numbered 10 and 6, Sothisil sees shadows and nothing more, for the Daedra are the lie that creation tells itself. Like their father Padme, they are nothing. And that's an interesting take on creation, I think, because the Aedra definitely gave of themselves to be part of Mundus, whereas the Daedra said, no, we're not going to be part of it, we're just going to hang back here and build our own things. So if you think about creation in the sense of Mundus, then the Daedra being involved at all and having any sway over Mundus doesn't make sense on a conceptual level. If they are entirely excluded from the creation of Mundus, then why do they meddle with it? Why do they do certain things? And so this is taking the idea that something has gone wrong in the sense that they've been fooled into thinking that the Daedra are relevant for Mundus in some way, or to Mundus in some way. And in the Tamriel final, nothing shall hold no sway, Anuvanasi. Their black mountain called Oblivion shall sink into the furnace of forgotten numbers, where all lies burn and brittle multitudes turn to slag. And that seems to imply that Tamriel final, that the final version of the world, is in some way going to reshape the whole Arabis. You remember before when it's talked about the Nern prior and the Nern ensuing as the past and the present, but Tamriel final is what's been referred to here, not Nern final. We don't see Nern final anywhere in the truth in sequence. And Tamriel final in this telling is something that will encompass all of the Arabis, that there won't be any Oblivion. Does that mean there won't be any Aetherius? I'm not totally sure, but it's interesting that Sothisil, or at least Sothisil's disciples, think that Sothisil can reshape the whole of the cosmos in what he's trying to do. It would be interesting to see if the Clockwork City has any forms of orrery and how well that matches up to the orreries that we see in The Elder Scrolls IV and Redguard, I think. Because if there are any differences there, it's possible that we have a design for what Tamriel final is, and that the final form of the cosmos as a whole is what's being shown there, that it's another case of a fetish, that you are putting something into place, and so, and in manipulating that thing, you're hoping to manipulate the thing it represents, which is potentially what Sothisil is doing with the Clockwork City as a whole. I hear you ask, if the Daedra are of the nothing, how do they lurk on our threshold? How do they lurk at all? Hear the words in sequence, child of the tribunal. In the clumsily built Nurn Prior, the Etada gears left gaps and crevices where nothing could take root, imperfections born from Lorcan's great lie and the selfishness of fractured creation. And this is a reference to the wheel model of the Arabis, from what I can tell. There's the idea that the Arabis is shaped like a wheel with spokes, that you have the hub, which is Mundus, and you have eight spokes, which are the Aedra that are supporting Mundus, and the gaps between the eight, which are 16, are the Daedric Princes, or the Daedric Princedoms. So we have there a reference to the idea that the way that the Arabis is put together is in some way imperfect or flawed. Although it would be possible that I think Sothisil is looking to reshape the Arabis into something altogether different, because the other model that we have that is like the Arabis is the Hurling Disc, where the spokes are all blurred into one. That's typically used to refer to dragon breaks and untime and things like that. So I don't think, if we're going to carry on with the metaphor of the wheel, that Sothisil would want to build a Hurling Disc or a disc of any sort. So quite what Tamriel Final would be if it was going to be represented by that form of a metaphor, I don't honestly know. In the glorious Anuit convergence of the Nurn ensuing, all gaps will be sealed, all crevices will be welded, the creaking and rattling of the machine shall retreat to a whisper, and the reckless chaos born from the Etada gear's folly shall shrivel and starve. By the word, I wind the gears. So we're looking at some perfected creation there, that you'll still see parts moving, but they will all be moving in unison and all perfectly fitting and so on and so forth. Everything will know its place, there won't be any gaps and so on. It's a machinist's version of perfection, I guess you could say, but I don't know quite what that means for how the world is going to be, unless we're just simply going to be working towards the reunification of Anu's psyche, if we're going to start thinking about the world as Anu's dream and looking at it from the perspective of being an Amaranth going on within Anu's head. That I'm not sure on, and quite what it would then mean for all the gaps and so on to be sealed. It makes me think, are we going back to a singular consciousness here and going back to Anu being the only thing that really functions? That doesn't really feel like it, because it's still talking about a machine whispering somewhere in the background, which implies moving parts, which implies multiple parts and so on. And on that very unsatisfying note of I'm not really sure, that's going to be it for this week. Thank you ever so much for listening. I do hope you've enjoyed my going through Volume 3 of The Truth and Sequence. If you want to join in the rest of the community that I'm building, please join the Written in Uncertainty Discord and discuss the lore there. There will be links to that in the show notes. If you want to support the show, you can become a patron at patreon.com/writteninuncertainty, or you can drop me a tip at ko-fi.com/Aramithius. That's ko-fi.com/Aramithius. And next week, we will be looking at Volume 4 of The Truth and Sequence, which looks at things like belief and truth, and to an extent remaking things as well, although that's pretty much a theme throughout the whole of The Truth and Sequence. It's more about remaking the self, which is part of that, I think. I hope you will join me for that next week, and until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and hosted by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembosky and Jeremy Saul. You can check out Jan's work on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and Jeremy's Northerner Diaries is available for purchase and on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Hello.
Hi.
Do you like bad movies?
Do you find yourself defending bad movies, saying things like, well, the soundtrack was okay, or the costumes were pretty fun?
From the previous hosts of It's Not That Bad podcast, we bring you Fresh Tomatoes, the movie podcast, from Simone LaRue and Chad Ekovitz.
Every week, we review two movies that did not do well critically, but we say, hey, there are some nice things about them. Maybe Rotten Tomatoes was wrong.
Maybe they're all fools, and you should watch these movies regardless. We'll also talk about scenes that could have saved it, and we'll often refer to Simone's cats because they're amazing and adorable, and we love them.
And at the end of each review, we will tell you whether we would watch this movie again, or in what circumstances we would recommend you watch this movie.
So, join us on July 9th for the first drop of our main episode, and then 2 days later for our drop of our minisodes.
And on Robots Radio Podcast Network. Come see us on July 9th. We love you so much already.
Bye!
The definition of a cryptid is an animal that has been claimed to exist, but never proven to exist. As we binged our favorite Netflix series and slayed our toughest bosses in a video game, we began to wonder about these creatures that appeared and stoked our imagination. What was the inspiration for the Demogorgon, or the Dementor? Well, my name is Dave, and with my co-host Austin, we bring you the Crypticast. Every other Wednesday, we will bring you some information about our favorite modern cryptid. From TV to movies to video games, we explore nerd culture through the lens of extensively suspicious knowledge in cryptozoology. Find us on your favorite podcast service under the name The Crypticast, and follow us on social media at the_CryptidCast. Come join the growing community of Cryptomania.